having seven brain configurations as solutions of type 2B supergravity. So there was quite an intensive activity on this subject starting early 90s. And so we are interested in solutions of 2D supergravity solutions which correspond to non-trivial axion and dilaton field coupled to gravity. So we keep only these two terms in the 2D supergravity action, where C0 is the axion and phi is the dilaton here. And we are interested in solutions of the equations of motion of this action, which correspond to configurations which we can identify as the seven brain configurations. Namely, what we are interested in, we are interested in solutions which have this form of the metric, which has whose eight-dimensional part is flat and corresponds to the transversal directions along the wall volume of the seven brains. Plus, there is a conformal like metric in the two directions transverse to the seven brains. And we are interested in the solutions of the supergravity equations of motion, which preserves supersymmetry. So we are interested in DPS solutions. And this the preservation of supersymmetry requires the variation of the dilatina field and the gravitina field with respect to supersymmetry transformation remains zero. And in the solution, we assume that vacuum expectation values of these fields are zero and they remain the same upon supersymmetry transformations. So if we solve these conditions for the metric and the form of the parameter of the supersymmetry transformation, then we find that the generic supersymmetric solution, which corresponds to the seven brain, is characterized by the following properties of the axion and dilaton fields. So the axion dilaton field is turns out to be a holomorphic function of the transverse coordinates of the brain, and the supersymmetry parameter depends on another holomorphic function f and its complex conjugate, which also depends on the transverse coordinates of this solution, and it also satisfies the following projection property, so that among 32 parameters of this constant spinner epsilon zero, only 16 contribute to the supersymmetry transformations, which remain preserved. And that means that this solution preserves half of 32 supersymmetries of 2B supergravity. Now, the metric, the conformal factor of the metric is characterized by the imaginary part of the, basically by the dilaton here times the F squared of these metrics. This is a generic solution and which is defined locally, but we are interested in solutions which are globally well defined and have, for example, a finite energy or mass, and this imposes conditions on the form of these two functions tau and f, so that they are characterized by singular points and strings or branch cuts here. And the physical meaning of these singular points and branch cuts is that the singular point is the point where the seven brain is situated. Because as I have shown, the whole problem has boiled down to a two-dimensional problem in directions transverse to the brain. So from the point of view of this direction, the seven brains can be considered as point particles, and they sit here in the singular point of these functions, while the branch cuts have the physical interpretation of being a kind of Dirac strings, which correspond to the flux of the axion and field running from or to the brain from infinity. That to say it in different words, as we will see later, the seven brains couple electrically to the eight form the field potential, which is magnetically dual to the axion field. So that means that the seven brain couples to magnetically to the axion, and as in the case of the monopoles, for example, that means that their magnetic description requires the introduction of Dirac string objects, which manifest themselves as branch cuts of the analytic functions of these solutions. And locally, now we can see that the functions which have these properties, they locally, in the case of seven brains, have the following form, so that the exponent of the axion is equal to z minus z0, where z0 is this point where the brain sits, so that tau is locally a logarithm of this point. And on the other hand, the Q7 brain solution is characterized by the following local property of the axion function around the singular point here. So what we have here is essentially different function with respect to tau, which in principle I can represent again as exponent of some new capital tau function, which we'll encounter later as well. But this is just a field redefinition from this to this. But basically, from these two forms of the functions, one can clearly see the difference between the two solutions. And what are these tau 0 and q here? The q is a determinant of a 2x2 SL2R matrix, which when acts on some point tau 0 in the modulus space, keeps its invariance. So tau 0, by definition, is a fixed point of the SL2R transformations generated by this matrix q alpha beta. And this q alpha beta will correspond to the Q7 brain charge in the whole volume description of these objects. And so that, well, these are some more details about this fixed point transformation. So EQ to the Q is a 2x2 matrix. It's a SL2R matrix, and it acts on the complex axion dilaton as a projective transformation of this form, and and tau zero is, you see that tau zero is invariant under this transformation. So basically, this is the form of the Q7 brain solution, and one can see the difference of this solution from the standard seven brain solution. Now let us see what is the difference of between these two objects from the volume point of view. And to this end, let me remind the structure of the seven brain volume action, and it, how it couples to B supergravity fields. So basically, the seven brain action, the B seven brain action, consists of two terms. The first one is the Born-Infeld-like term, where GMN is the metric induced on the world volume of the brain by its interaction or embedding into 10-dimensional space. And Fmn here is the field strength of the Bornfeld field, which contains the curl of the Bornfeld potential extended by the pullback of on the wall volume of the seventh brain of the NS gauge field of 2B supergravity. Then the second term in this action is the Wessel-Minnet term, which describes the coupling of the D7 brain to all possible Ramon-Ramon fields of 2B supergravities and their dual. So the uniqueness of seven brains, and in particular the D7 brain, is that it couples to all possible Ramon-Ramon fields, 8, 6, C2, and C0, and their duals, and simultaneously. And the so the field strengths of these Ramon-Ramon field potentials are defined as the curls of the form of rank R plus the wedge product of the lower rank form times the field strength of the Nevius-Schwartz gauge field. And the duality between the different potentials which appear in the Wessel-Minnet term of the D7 brain has the following form. So the C0, which is the axion scalar, it's dual to the eighth form potential via the following form of duality between the derivative of the axion and the Hodge dual of the nine form field strengths of this field here. Then there is the duality between the 2 and 6 forms, which is the standard Hedge duality in 10 dimensions, and the 4 form potential is cell dual, as we know very well. Now, the structure of this action is invariant, is such that the action is invariant under gauge transformations of the Ramon-Ramon and Nevius-Schwartz field of the following form. So the action is invariant under this transformation, and the Wessel-Minnet term is constructed in a way to satisfy the, at least up to the total derivative of the, to be invariant under these transformations. And it's also important to know that this action is invariant under the shift symmetry of the axion field under the constant, with a constant parameter B, so that the axion gets shifted by B, and for example, the two form potentials get mixed under this axion shift symmetry. And this axion shift symmetry is actually a part of larger symmetry of the 2B supergravity, which is the S-duality or SL2R symmetry of 2B supergravity theory known since 1983. So to understand how the these Q7 brains appear in this picture, it's also necessary to understand the structure of SL2R symmetry of 2B supergravity. So let me remind you the main properties of 2B supergravity fields under the SL2R symmetry transformations. So I'll concentrate on the bosonic sector of 2B supergravity, which, as we have seen in the previous part, consists of the graviton and the following Ramon-Ramon and Nevius-Schwartz fields. The with respect to the SL2R transformations, the graviton and the four form potential are singlets, while the two form and six form potentials naturally form the SL2R doublets. They transform linearly under the SL2R transformations. And as far as the axion that Dilapon is concerned, the situation here is more complicated, and so that they transform nonlinearly under SL2R, and the form of their transformation can be recovered by considering them as coordinates of the coset space SL to R slash SO2. And so that they parameterize this coset in the following way. One can construct symmetric 2x2 matrix M alpha beta using the dilaton and axion functions in the following way, so that these functions, this matrix satisfy the orthogonality condition of this form, where epsilon is the antisymmetric matrix, and it transforms under an action of the group element of the SL2R in this way. So that using this transformation law, one can recover how the axion and dilaton fields transform themselves under the SL2R transformation. Using this matrix, it's useful to introduce a kind of axion dilaton field strands, which is a triplet one form. So this is just a Cartan form, Cartan-like form constructed of this matrix M in this way. And one should know that the trace of these field strands with the matrix M itself is identically zero by the construction. That means basically that among three independent components of this symmetric matrix F alpha beta, only two are independent. And this just showed the fact that we have two independent scalars in our model, basically. And in terms of these one form field strands, one can reproduce the kinetic term for the axion and dilaton in a Maxwell like form written here. Now, the question is, what is this C8 field and how it transforms under the SL2R transformations, or how it's related to some field which takes the values in SL2R? And this happens in the following way. Using these four field strands for the axion dilaton, one can dualize it into the nine form, and which is again a symmetric matrix, and it satisfies the following Bianchi identities due to the 2B supergravity equations of motion. And well, the leading term of this nine form starts with the curl of the eight form potential here. And again, because of the duality and this identity here, this triplet of nine forms, it satisfies this condition, so that among the three components of these nine forms, only three forms are independent, basically. So we have not three, but two independent eight form potentials. So this is how we arrive at a triplet of eight forms. And now we should identify what is this C8. And the choice which we can make is, and which is actually dictated by the form of the D7 brain action, is that we can identify the C8, which to which the D7 brain couples minimally, as a 2-2 component of this eight-form matrix A. And we can write it formally in this form, that I can introduce a constant matrix which I define QD, which has a single non-zero component on the diagonal here one, and I identify this matrix Q with a D7 brain charge, so that one can think of this Q as a matrix charge of the D7 brain, which ensures its minimal coupling to the triplet of eight forms in such a way that it reproduces the Ramon 8 form potential in the D7 brain action. I should say here, so formally what we have done is that we have represented this 8 form in a manifestly SL2R invariant way. But of course, since Q is constant, that does not mean that under the SL2R transformations, this combination of charges and fields remain invariant. And the fact that this charge is constant is just shows that in spite of the fact that 2B supergravity is invariant under SL2R transformations, when it couples to D-brains and other objects, then the SL2R transformation actually gets broken down to the shift transformation of the axion field, which I demonstrated to in the previous slide. So that different brains which have different cues here form different classes of brains with respect to the SL2R transformations.
The source brains will transform, right?
Yes.
It will be a background which has different.
Yes.
AQ brains.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Why would you say it's broken?
A single brain. If you take a D7 brain and we take their SL2R transformation, it does not remain the D7 brain. It becomes the Q brain. But it's broken. No, it just means that it's not as that we under the SL2R transformation we remain in with the same brain. Actually, that means that this transformation leads us to different kind of brains and actually to different kind of perturbative theory, I would say. Yes. Let me now identify what is the exponent of the dilaton in terms of these SL2R objects. So it's nothing but the trace of the D7 brain charge with the axion dilaton matrix here, as you can see from the definition of this matrix. And now, as actually you said, now we can introduce the PQ brains by making the U1 transformations, SL2R transformations of their charges, so that we can consider brains which differ from this one by SL2R transformation the point is that if you make this transformation, then the determinant of this charge remains zero. So they all are in the same conjugacy class of the SL2R transformation. And that basically means that this 2x2 matrix can be presented as a direct product of two vector components on one, two vectors, so to say, the Q alpha. And these components can be identified with the numbers Q and P, which, and this is why the name PQ brains appear, basically. But now, in quantum theory, as we know, these PQ charges are quantized so that the SL2R transformations get broken to SL2Z, but I will not distinguish the difference in my talk because I only consider the classical theory here. Then what are the Q7 brains? And the Q7 brains are the objects which are not in the same conjugacy class as the D7 brains, so that their charge matrix Q has non-zero determinant. And so that it can never be obtained by an SL2R transformation from the charge of the D7 brain. No, it can have any determinant, which is no, Q is small q is in the algebra of SL2R, so that e to the q is the SL2R element. E to the Q. E to the Q has the determinant one. Yeah. But Q itself can have any determinant in general. Okay. So now what we are interested in, we would like to understand whether and to which extent we can try to construct the world volume theory on these new Q7 brains, and how these Q7 brains couple to the 2B supergravity fields. And let me again show this D7 brain action, and we would like to construct something similar for these new objects. And we start with the Born-Infeld term, but actually, let's first put to zero the Born-Infeld field itself, and let's concentrate on the Nambu-Gotha part of this action. So the coupling of this Q7 brain to the axion and dilaton, which we assume has the following form. So we introduce, instead of the exponent of the dilaton, we introduce some function of T, which is the trace of the charge of the Q7 brain with the dilaton matrix M alpha beta here. Again, here is the form of this matrix. So one, for a definite Q alpha beta, one knows explicitly what this new field means. And one can also see that when Q alpha beta is the D7 brain charge, that this T reduces to e to the phi. No, the tension is defined by this combination of axion and dilaton, so it's different. So it's defined by the expectation value of this T. This assumption comes from the analysis of the seven brain solutions, which I demonstrated. Yeah, so basically this form of coupling is suggested by studying the solution, the source in the form of the source in the solution of seven brain, which corresponds to the configuration which I have shown. So this is has this meaning. But physically, it's also natural, because when we take the dead Q limit going to zero, then we recover the standard D7 brain coupling. Sorry? The G string is the conventional G string coupling is of course e to the phi, right? So here of course T is not small when we take small G string. So this means that actually this object is not well perturbatively defined, I think, in terms of the conventional stream coupling constant. Yes. And yes. No, and here it's not. In these terms, it's not like that. And here is actually the problem with their description, I think, is effective field description. I will probably tell more about this a bit later. Sorry, in which sense you mean? No, one can, well, let me proceed a bit and we'll see which restrictions arise for them.
So M is of order one over G string, right? So so for Q is of order one, right? The tension is of order one over G string, which is very heavy. I mean, there is e to the minus 2 phi in the m alpha beta.
Yes, but when you compute it.
Okay, so what am I missing?
Well, you have to multiply by q.
Yes, so.
Could q like that?
Yes, in general, okay. When you take the limit, it does not go to infinity.
But that's not always happened, right? So I can.
No, of course. But it happens basically. In these cases of Q7, which are, well, the most interesting, I don't know. Okay, so now we would like to restore the minimal coupling term of these Q7 brains. And naturally, we can take this seven brain charge multiplied by the 8-form potential just by analogy, and that's it. When F, so now the question is, since we would like to also to see other terms in the in this action, one may ask the question: what is the scalar field dual of this 8-form potential? And remember that in the standard case, the 9-form dual of the axion had the following form. And now we can recover the analogous relation for the field strands of this guy by considering the trace of the 1-form field strands with Q alpha beta and computing this expression here using the explicit form of this matrix. So, and you see that here what we have is T squared minus 4Q, where Q is the determinant of the charge matrix here, and chi prime is the which is under the derivative is another function of the axion and dilaton, which is rather complicated, but which we can compute explicitly. So you see here, for example, there is a kind of expression which puts some restriction on the possible values of t, so that t squared, the minimum which one have is T squared equals 4Q. This is one of the restrictions which one finds here. And you see, for example, here we have the string coupling constant, basically, which goes to zero. Well, I mean, when it's very small, then this goes to zero somehow. And the same thing happens here when p is equal to 4q and not equal zero here in this case. Okay, so as I have shown, what we have found, we have found two different scalar fields, which I called T and Q and chi prime, to which this Q7 brain couples in some sense minimally. And they differ from the axion and dilaton, but they are nothing but the Filger definition of the axion and dilaton. So from the point of view of supergravity action, what we have done, actually, we have only made the Filger definition of the axion and dilaton fields in a different way. And in the type 2B theory, it's string supergravity itself, this is nothing but the field transformation. And for example, the kinetic term for the axion and dilaton written in the form of this new T and chi prime, it has the following form here. And so that it's also quite simple in spite of the fact that T and chi are complicated functions of the original axion dilaton. And on the left-hand side, and when Q equals zero, then these two parts coincide identically. And but when Q is non-zero, they have the different form. And the shift symmetry of the original kinetic term of the axion dilaton, which we had on the left-hand side, it gets replaced by the shift symmetry of this new axion chi prime with respect to some parameter alpha. And this shift symmetry of chi prime corresponds to the following SL2R transformation of the axion dilaton matrix with the generator Q alpha beta. So this is how these two scalar choices, the choices of the basis of the scalar fields are related to each other. But it turns out that it matters how the brain object couples to these fields. So it's not the same as we start with, as I have shown, that with a brain which couples minimally to phi and c, or it couples minimally to p and chi prime, or to the dual magnetic dual of chi prime, to be precise. So let me try to proceed and to try to construct and restore the complete form of the Q7 brain as a Zamina term now. And so the construction of this term is basically based on the requirement that this term should contain the minimal coupling of this brain to the eighth form, and we have seen how it looks like. And but then since the this eighth form is transformed under the Gedge transformations in an appropriate way, then one should add additional terms to the Vezumina term to respect this Gedge transformation. And also, we will require that the complete Vezumina term is invariant under the shift symmetry of the axion field, which I again represent in this way, and the shift symmetry is generated by the charge of this seven brain. And as I said, we require that the Vezumina term is invariant under the Gedge transformations of the whole set of Ramon-Ramon potentials, or their SL2R analogs. And if we try to satisfy all these requirements, then the Vezumina term takes the following form. So it has this Q7 brain charge multiplied by the following combination of the Ramon-Ramon fields. And there is the last term here, which is invariant under the shift symmetry of chi prime, though it's not, one cannot see this manifestly, but it seems that this is the most simple form of this part of the Vesemir term. And I remember that tau zero is, again, the fixed point of the SL2R transformations generated by the matrix Q here. And what are these F2? These are a doublet of two Born-Winfield fields, which is required for the gauge invariance of these Q7 brains. So, and here comes the main difference of these objects from the D7 brains, that if you want to have a Vesemir, gauge invariant Vesemir coupling, then we should introduce two and not one Born-Winfield field into on the wall volume of these Q7 brains.
Well, it should have two. Yes, we have not managed to construct the complete DBI part, but I'll comment about this in the next slide right now. And one can also show that when the determinant of Q goes to zero, then this Vesemir term reduces to the B7 brain Vesemir term, and it follows in the following way that in this limit, the matrix Q alpha beta can be represented as the product of two vector components, and which then project out a single Born-Winfield field only, which remains in the action. And that, then we arrive back to the Vesemir term, which describes the D7 brain coupling. Now, what terms are missing? And the one of these terms is the term which corresponds to the Born-Winfield part. And one way to try to restore the form of this term is to require that the complete action is invariant under the one half of supersymmetries of 2-bit theory, basically. And what we have managed to do is, we can assume, as we have seen, that these Q7 brain configurations, they preserve one-half supersymmetric, so they are one-half supersymmetric solution, so that one can assume that the complete action should have one-half supersymmetry, and that means that the variation of the Vesemir part of the action with respect to this supersymmetry transformation should be cancelled by the variation of the Born-Winfield part. And what we have checked that up to the quadratic terms in F, there appears the following form of the DBI part of the action. So it starts with the Nambu-Gotha term T, which we have already seen, and plus the kinetic term for these two Born-Winfield fields. But higher order terms are not known here. Then the second ingredient, which actually we are lacking is the fermionic part. And the fermionic part can be introduced by the standard procedure by considering the motion of these brains in super space rather than in the bosonic 10-dimensional space, so that we are, if we consider the embedding of the wall volume of this brain in the superspace with 32 fermionic coordinates, then what we have is that the brain bosons are described by the orthogonal oscillations of these brains in bosonic directions, and fermionic modes correspond to these fermionic coordinates in superspace. But if we, and here another problem arises, so that if we assume that the Q7 brain theory is actually a supersymmetric one, then the number of boson and fermion degrees of freedom should match. And
In the case of the D7 brain, we know that they match because we have a single Born-Imfeld field. We have two transverse scalar degrees of freedom, and we have fermions. And these on the mesh shell have the following number of degrees of freedom. So we have 6 plus 2 bosonic and 8 fermionic degrees of freedom, where gamma is the kappa symmetry projector, or the projector which singles out 1/2 of remaining supersymmetries, as I demonstrated already at the beginning. But now, in the case of the Q7 brain, we have a second Born-Imfeld field, so that to measure the degrees of freedom, one should introduce the two more scalars and 8 more vectors on the whole volume of the of these brains. And so the question arises, what is the nature, actual nature of these objects, and what these fields come from? And whether one can consider these Q7 brains as an object on which different strings end. If it was so, then the two Born-Imfeld fields might be induced by the endpoints, say, of the fundamental string and the D1 brain, which end on this object here. Then, but the most, but then, what about scalars? And scalars seem to be related to the fact that actually this guy should be a bound state of two D brains, one say D7 brains and another one a PQ brain, so that it's SL2R rotated D7 brain with one with fundamental string and another one with corresponding PQ string ending on them, so that they somehow form the bound state, and this produces the Q7 brain effective theory. And here it is, this picture is analogous to what, to some extent, to what we have in the case of coincident D brains. And I think that the construction of the complete volume effective action for these Q7 brains faces very similar problems that the construction of the complete, especially supersymmetric action for coincident D brains faces. And this action is still unknown. So I think at this point, I should make my conclusions basically. And let me again list the properties of these objects, so that we learn that these Q7 brains are 1/2 VPRS solutions of to B supergravity, and they are characterized by minimal coupling to the 8 form potentials with the charge matrix, which is characterized by non-zero determinant, and they couple to a different combination of the dilaton and axion field in the, so that their tension is determined by some different combination of the axion and dilaton field, and that I have shown that the gauge invariance of the Q7 brain coupling to all other fields of to B supergravity requires 2 Born-Imfeld fields on their volume. And then the questions which I have tried to address but still require the complete answer is, what is the nature of these Q7 brains? And are they surfaces on which 2 different strings end, or some kind of bound state of the strings, and whether they are the bound states of 2 different D7 brains rotated to, or PQ7 brains, which produce the correct spectrum on the wall volume of these brains. And then one may ask even more exotic questions, whether there may exist other Q objects which couple in a different way to the axion and dilaton. And I should say that in the paper with Bergschoff, Hartung, and Plog, we have found that indeed there exists Q instantons, so the dual objects to these Q7 brains. And probably if I have 3 minutes, I can say a couple of words about these Q instantons. So basically, so the instantons are one half the best solutions of Euclidean to B supergravity. And in the case of D instantons, we are interested in the solutions of the weak rotated axion dilaton system, which satisfies the following Bogomolny bound condition, so that the derivative of C is equal to plus minus e to the minus phi d phi. And one can compute the classical instanton action, which takes the following form. It's just the axion dilaton function times 2 pi I. In the similar fashion, we can start with these the axion dilaton kinetic term of 2B supergravity written in terms of these new scalars T and chi, and make the big rotation of these and arrive at a different BPS system, which is characterized by the following BPS boundary condition and by the following classical instanton action written here. And here we again see what are kind of limits on the possible form of T here. Okay, so I can also say that what we have shown is that it seems that these Q instantons may contribute to the to the higher derivative terms in the effective action of string theory, so the R to the fourth terms, and we have found that there are points in the modular space which describes the Eisenstein, this modular function beta in front of the R to the four terms, which corresponds to to these Q instantons, which may correspond, I would say, to the contribution of these Q7 instantons. And probably the existence of this object may indicate that there might exist also a kind of new unexplored vacuum of to be string theory, and the points where this vacuum may situated can be seen in this plot, which represents the fundamental domain which describes the fundamental part of the modular space of the axion and dilaton field, which is characterized by the orbifold SL2 R slash SL2 divided by this discrete group, and which has the following form, so that this is a strip here with the points rho and I here, with these points here identified with these points, and these point lines here, vertical lines, are identified with these lines here by the discrete symmetry transformations. And these are the fixed points of this modular space. There are two fixed points, and at which the Q7 brains and Q instantons are situated, basically. So they are sit in a different fixed points of this modular space in comparison with the D brains, for which the string coupling constant is goes to zero. And probably there, one might try to think of the effective theory of these objects as a kind of perturbative theory around these points in the modular space. I think that these are these points. Oh, massless, sorry. No, yes. No, I don't know. That's. Yeah, maybe. Okay, I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
So on the line for the others, say Q1, Q3, Q5 frames. So have you tried to take some key duality for the Q7 frame?
Oh, key duality does not work here, let's see. It doesn't, it may not help. Maybe if one try to think of these Q7 grains as objects on which some, say, Q1 string ends, which has some properties which produces their ordering states, then one can try to recover what is the form of this Q1 grain, for example, and then consider how it ends on other objects. But key duality, this is also an open question. There is no direct key duality between these Q7 grains and some objects in the type 2A theory. And that was analyzed somehow by Bertholdt with collaborators when they made recovered these 7 brains from domain walls in 9-dimensional supergravity theories, which they obtained by shared Schwartz reduction from type 2B. So they made a shared Schwartz reduction of type 2B supergravity down to 9 dimensions, and they found that at certain parameters in 9 dimensions, there appear the domain walls, which then can be get lifted back to 10 dimensions, and they give rise to these Q7 brains. And then they have analyzed what happens when one makes, Schwartz dimensional reduction of type 2A theory or the dimensional reduction of massive 2A supergravity. And it turns out that not all domain wall solutions which one can obtain from the theory which comes from type 2A is correspond to the ones which are obtained from 2B theory. And exactly these Q7 brains don't match the two dimensional reductions.
Maybe sort of going along the same direction, but in principle, you have a supergravity solution in type 2B. So you can take that supergravity solution and do a T-duality, right, as a solution of type 2B strings here. So you will get some different background. And presumably, it will correspond to whatever. You will get some SMEAD Q.
Well, maybe it somehow corresponds to some non-local. I don't know.
Well, maybe can you pinpoint where is there? If I would use the T-duality rule, so what will go wrong? I mean, I thought that if I have a local type 2B supergravity background, right, I can always do a T-duality along a U1 isometry, and I will get, again, a local solution, right? So by isometry, I will take one of the world volume direction of the Q7 brain vectify it on the surface.
But maybe the thing is that you, what, as you said, what you'll end up with, you would try and interpret as a smeared object. Right. You would still have to guess what the localized object is.
Yeah, I understand the issue. The reason is that those are funny objects. They are, well, Jamel was pointing out that and use it as well, that they alight. So typically, if they alight, you expect that they will fluctuate strongly, or at least, you know. So to which extent the classical description is valid? And what I want to, okay, where I was heading is that going back to like Q3 and use ADS CFT and try to guess, is there, you know, what is this light object that you are talking about? Does it have any correspondence in some four-dimensional Young Mill series?
No, that's the question, which there's no answer to. So,
but in principle, I'm saying that the steps are sort of, we know we can do it. Well, it will not be a localized object, right? So it will be some smeared stuff, but I think it will still be light. Presumably it will still be, you know, half a supersymmetric. Then the issue will be, can we construct that object? So you will construct this with asymptotically flat. I mean, then you would
have input type 2A.
Well, I won't eventually go to type 2B, so, but, and then see if I can, yeah, if I can construct it with asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, so that see exactly what that's saying.
Yeah, probably it can be done, or at least one can make this analysis, but we haven't done this yet.
Can I think you were telling me this just a moment ago, but. So you're saying there are, well, just let me ask the question. So you, as you presented it, there are some interesting supergravity solutions, and that gave rise to a whole set of analysis. But is there something, a situation that says, you know, these are an essential ingredient of string theory, you know, by some kind of duality or something, if I take known objects, I'll end up with these objects. And so, you know, this is a part of sort of the string theory menagerie.
Well, okay, probably, I don't know if it convinces you that the only, we have tried to think of in these terms, of course, and the only example which we have found is these Q7 instantons, which are dual to the 7 brains, which seem to contribute to the effective to the higher order corrections to the effective action of to the string theory at the different points of the modular function. Exactly at these points. So when one computes the contribution of the conventional D instantons into the modular function of R to the 4 terms, the expansion of these modular functions goes around the small coupling, string coupling constant. And then one sees that in this expansion, one sees the contribution, the sum of the contribution of multiple instantons with the actions which I presented. So if you do the same expansion of the modular function, but around these points, then we recover the series of terms where the contribution is exactly in the form of these Q7 brain instanton actions, which
presumably small there.
Yeah. Yes. Black. So at these points, the contribution is has exactly this form there in the modular function. Mm-hmm. So this is probably.
But when I get to that point, are you saying I'm replacing, you know, what I thought was an expansion having to do with D instantons by an expansion that has to do with your Q instantons now? Or are you saying I see that the D instanton expansion, which I would have assumed broke down, but you're saying it's incomplete in some way and I have to add something?
Yes. I think that we should add. Because the D instanton contribution basically is around some point in the modular space.
But it's the same on the function.
Yes, with the same modular function.
Not even the function.
But, yes.
So the function knows about these objects as well.
Well, we assume that it knows. Yes.
We can go very far from this Q7. Brain in two-dimensional surface.
you see approximate that space, right?
Yeah.
Means that you can place the three brains, which are mutually DPS, seven brains.
In principle, yeah, one can study also means.
Means it's the solution of Q7 brain in ADS 5 exists. So you can get it close.
Well, I would not say.
It is different in supergravity.
No, but it's a bit.
You mean in the Borov solution? But he doesn't have the action.
Yes.
And this is the solution of supergravity.
Well, but it's a bit different when you, I think.
Sorry, but one of your pictures is cube brains is some bound states of ordinary PQT7 brain. So from this perspective, I would interpret the Q instanton as some complicated multi-instanton effects, but still the instanton effect. So why? So I guess it's not immediately. So it doesn't still answer the question whether there is some very sharp pictures that we see, for example, something like, you know, a resolution of a conifold of a conical singularity would require us, you know, a wrapped brain. So we know that that singularity is resolved by a massless wrapped D brain. So is there something which would unambiguously tell that that's indeed an independent object and not some, you know, complicated collective dynamics of the instantons?
Oh, well, I would say that I don't know. Yes. But in principle, at least one can, if one would think of these Q instantons as some collective behavior of the instantons, that I think would be not very simple to recover the results regarding, for example, the contribution to the arc, the four terms, as if one starts directly from some effective description in terms of these Q instantons and treating them as some independent objects, and then the structure, the simpler structure appears in a simpler way. So, but I should admit that there is no any strong evidence of the uniqueness or of these objects in post-string theory.
So for the bound state, the conjecture, so do you think there's a simple way to check? I mean, say suppose I have two PQ7 brains, so there's, let's say, different PMQs. So it seems if I have a bound state, then the total monotony, so that as I go around the two brains, probably will just be.
Yes. The monotony, actually, this, in some sense, this. The monodromy property supports this idea, but in somewhat not direct way, in the sense that if we have say the monodromy is characterized by e to the q, where q is the charge of the brain. So if you take one the D brain and another D brain and make and multiply here, then this will give the monotony of the Q7 brain. But the charge itself then will have the following form, just because these are matrices. So this will be something like Q1. And the commutator of Q1 and Q2. So what happens is that monodromy seems to match, but the Q7 brain charge is not the direct sum of this Q1 and Q2, but it has the
this additional piece here. So in some sense, if one considers the bound state, then one would expect that the charge sums up.
But actually, the real bound state is the charge on that, the EQ string.
But
at least the mass formula.
Right. But if you take the PQ string, for the same conjugacy class, I think this term vanishes. So there will be no this contribution.
But I think what John was saying is basically is that since the concept that replace the charge conservation should be preserving the monogamy. So it seems that's already evidence. And yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that I don't see a reason why the charge is so much.
No, in the case of two deep brains.
Yeah,
the two deep brains in this.
I guess what I'm saying is that
will sum up.
Right. So the two charges are not two charges that commute.
They don't commute, right?
Right.
So they're mutually non-local charges. So
yes.
You don't expect them to be.
Right.
I don't say that I would expect this. I just said that yes, they mutually don't commute, and that means that the structure here is.
But it's just you presented this as sort of an evidence, the charge expression against the idea of the bound state.
I just wanted to stress that the charge itself.
Right.
Is not the sum of the two charges what one might expect naively from the point of view.
Which is the same with if I take two PQ D7 brains, so the monodromy when they're on top of one another, I don't think it's P1 plus P2, P1 plus P2 monodromy.
Well, it depends in general.
In general, yeah.
And the reason for that is because the P charge and Q charge don't commute. So there is no reason for them to
sum up.
And this is natural.
Yes.
A natural expectation. That's it.